Welcome back to another sci-fi episode, where today we're going to examine how we think, feel, and behave with money, especially as it deals with compulsive spending. Subtitle, Unpacking What You're Really Trying to Buy. So this was a class that I provided on September 4th, along with the Employee Assistance Program. They were doing a whole addiction series, so on substances and other addictive behaviors. And so this one came to mind. You've heard Carolyn speak on the podcast before. She wanted me to do something on compulsive spending. I was more than happy to do that. It's not something that is readily known to a lot of folks. Usually when we think of compulsive spending, we think of shopaholics or other terms that are not necessarily clinical in nature.
Or gambling addiction.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But gambling receives a bigger place at the table when it comes to the American Psychiatric Association and what they will deem appropriate for the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental and Emotional Disorders. But I do have with me Matt. You've already heard him speaking. Matt is our accredited financial counselor candidate, and he is going to be my sidekick today again. It's always nice to have more of a dynamic discussion with these topics. So I do want to let you know that there's also a podcast you may want to hear after listening to this. Hopefully, if you're one of those folks that you say to yourself, either I might be engaging in compulsive spending behavior or I know someone who is, the Examining Overspending podcasts are in season one, episodes 12 and 13. It actually gives you tools on how to help your loved one or yourself when it comes to overspending. But it also talks more about the brain science behind overspending. So that'll be a nice adjunct to include with this actual podcast. Now, I will tell you that after I took a continuing education class, I couldn't wait to provide this training. This information was provided by, it was a recording that I watched, a webinar, an old webinar provided by Dr. April Lane Benson. She is a clinician, a PhD clinician, who pioneered the theory and treatment for compulsive buying. And what she did, she also treated eating disorders. And she found that compulsive buying and eating disorder symptomatology overlapped, especially when it comes to restricting and then binging. What we tend to do, and I'm sure there are a lot of head nods as you're driving your car or whatever you're doing, changing a diaper, listening to this podcast, my goodness, that makes so much sense. Because even in our spending habits, we tend to restrict ourselves to the point where we're not satisfied. And then as a result of wanting, because we haven't rewarded ourselves or we haven't made our spend plans realistic or comfortable, then we binge spend. So I'm going to get into the clinical underpinnings of spending behavior. And before I do, I want to get you thinking about what this is. I asked the audience when I provided this class, before I even tell you or give you my own notes, what shall we call overspending? And so in the chat, a lot of people were putting in, or they were unmuting their mics, coming on and saying compulsive buying or shopaholics, overspenders, different names. Someone even said retail therapy, which is a more acceptable term in a social setting for overspending behavior. Mm-hmm. But is that fair to the individual or to society when we just look at it as like, oh, she just has, this is just her retail therapy. Well, when it's actually causing huge problems mm-hmm. in the home, or maybe even with his or her security clearance, and now their livelihood is at stake, no longer will we call it retail therapy.
But I think what you're hinting at is there's a problem.
Yes.
Right? I think there's a big difference between buying something as a little treat to yourself, or you know what, I'm having a bad day. I'm gonna get a cup of coffee.
Mm.
And you know what? Today I'm gonna buy myself a croissant too.
Yes.
Right?
I'm having a bad day.
Uh-huh.
The behavior or routine, I'm gonna buy myself a coffee and baked good with that.
The reward is I feel a little better. It's a little treat. Boom. Now, does it become a habit?
Mm-hmm.
As a result, like, is that reinforcement back at it? And I think there's a big difference between something small just to lift your spirits every once in a while.
Right.
Versus, because then it's still a treat.
Yeah.
Or do you treat it to where it becomes the expectation?
Right.
Right. Like the nice thing has become the norm.
Exactly. And we need to find a way to sever that connection. So whether we call it compulsive buying, pathological buying, shopping addiction, overspending, buying shopping disorder, compulsive buying shopping disorder, or disordered shopping, we must validate that it is an issue with a lot of people. We never want to minimize the issue. And I love how Dr. Benson, in her talk for this continuing education class, she entitled it, "You Can Never Get Enough of What You Don't Really Need." And that really sums up what compulsive buying is, mm-hmm. because it is a compulsion. It's a behavior that is repeated over and over and over again to satiate something that is missing, mm-hmm. to fill a void, so to speak.
But you haven't identified the void.
Yes.
And attacked the reality of what is really eating at you.
Right. And I noticed how you lowered your voice there, because it's a very serious issue.
It is.
That we're dealing with. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to scream it from the rafters when some folks might be scared away from that. But let me talk a little bit about the history of compulsive buying. In 1899, Emil Kraepelin called it oniomania, the pathological propensity to buy, which is also the abnormal impulse to buy. And to quote him, he said, "This is characterized by uncontrolled shopping and spending, with unremitting delay in payments, accumulation of debts, and the inability to disengage cognitively or to apprehend the negative consequences of buying excesses." This was happening in 1899. There is nothing new under the sun. This is something we've been dealing with. And so with that, there's this strong, like he said, this inability to disengage from our thinking, our cognitions, and then we just continue to spend until we have just gone to excess. Then you also have the International Classification of Disease, 11th edition, which they actually do have a diagnosis there in that classification as impulse control disorder, other specified compulsive buying shopping disorder. Now, as a therapist, I did have to use the ICD, or International Classification of Disease, to be paid out by HMOs, but we also had to use the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental and Emotional Disorders. But the American Psychiatric Association, they pen and author the DSM-5. But what they say is there's still insufficient peer-reviewed evidence to establish the diagnostic criteria and course descriptions needed to identify these behaviors as mental disorders. And I got to tell you, as a clinician, I'm glad that they did that. And here's why. Because we tend to medicalize things that are concerns, but they don't warrant a medical diagnosis. For example, people are already overusing the clinical term trauma. Did you know there's now a new term called financial trauma? And I don't buy into it. There absolutely are traumatic incidents that occur clinically, but we have medicalized so many things that don't need to be medicalized. But we don't want to trivialize this either. I want to make that known. I'm not opposed to calling it whatever you want to call it. But do know that with the history of the compulsive shopping or compulsive buying, that not everyone recognizes it as a mental disorder. And so they've tried it out with some diagnostic criteria for compulsive buying that was introduced in 1994. It was in the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry. And just so you know, some of the things that would, it was a proposed set of criteria: maladaptive preoccupation with buying or shopping. The buying preoccupations, impulses, or behaviors cause marked distress, are time-consuming, significantly interfere with social or occupational functioning, or result in financial problems. And not everyone thinks of indebtedness or bankruptcy as an overarching, huge problem. But when you are about to lose your security clearance and therefore your job, it is a big problem. So gambling disorder is in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental and Emotional Disorders. The American Psychiatric Association saw it fit to place gambling addiction in there, but not compulsive buying. They're looking at it as a different frame until I'm provided something else. I try to find other ways that I can approach this and treat it. And I love Dr. Benson's work because of that. She was a pioneer in treating the obsessive or compulsive buying. So what she found was, is what leads to this compulsive buying behavior? And she looked at the antecedents, or the things that occur prior to the urge to buy compulsively. A lot of us would think negative emotions precede that buying event or binging event. But actually, she found that the relief of the negative emotions is the most common immediate reaction. So think about Friday afternoon, you're leaving work, the negative feelings are releasing, and now you're moving towards Bridge Street. I gave Bridge Street as the example. It's on my way home, and that's dangerous. I've already classified myself and have shared with the audience that I am a recovering overspender. I mean, non-clinical, but at the same time, I have to track my spending throughout the month and stock my money so that I keep those guardrails up. So when I see Bridge Street to my right every time I come home, I have to remind myself that if I had an exceptionally bad week and I'm going home on a Friday and those negative feelings are starting to release, that is probably going to be the primary trigger for blowing the budget and going to DSW, going to all of my favorite places at Bridge Street. It's an outdoor mall for those that aren't familiar with Huntsville. But she also talks about the self-discrepancy gap, and that is the distance between where we are now and where we want to be. But when we add that self-discrepancy to material value on the item, when we attach that value to the item, then those become our strongest two predictive factors to compulsive buying. So compulsive buying can absolutely be an attempt too, because I provided a subtitle, as I always do, unpacking what you're really trying to buy. What Dr. Benson found is that people are wanting to move toward an ideal identity, and that's what they're attempting to buy with that constant shopping. Or they're attempting to repair mood, regain control of a situation, engage in a little revenge spending. I see that a lot, especially with folks that are on the brink of divorce mm-hmm. or have completed divorce. Mm-hmm. Or it's a way to respond to grief or trauma. And absolutely, this is where I don't want to disregard how trauma can lead to financial issues. Yeah. But then it's also a way to avoid, instead of approach what we really need. So we avoid creating a spend plan. We avoid tracking our spending. And if we avoid things, then we feel better about ourselves because then we're not seeing the damage that we've already done. But then quite uniquely, what she pointed out in this training is that connection, the desire for connection, seemed to be one of the stronger needs that were not being fulfilled in compulsive buying. And it's funny because we just had that mm-hmm. conversation in a previous episode when we were talking about shifting your financial mindset, how connection can actually increase or create a better financial habit.
Right.
So,
yeah.
So yeah. What are you really trying to satiate? And that's what we're trying to help you grasp as you are walking through this process of understanding, am I a compulsive shopper? Do I engage in these types of behaviors to meet the needs that aren't being met in other areas? And probably the answer is yes. And it might be to a lower degree. Mm-hmm. It might be buying someone's affection. I know for me as a mom with two girls, I love that they want to be around me. I love as teenagers, they still want to go shopping with me. But have there been times when I have lured them to be with me with the promise of an acai bowl or a Chick-fil-A milkshake? No army endorsement implied. that just came to my mind. But what is the actual reward?
It's funny because as you're saying that, I think about my own pattern with my own kids, right? Because so my kids live in Kansas City right now. And so I've spent the last year and change away from them. And so when I go back to visit them right now, I find myself going through a very similar pattern of where I go there and I knowingly overspend and I knowingly overdo it. Mm-hmm. And I do that time and time again. And I do that because before we were even talking about this, I was kind of sitting down and sitting thinking about this. And I do that because I don't get the time with them that mm-hmm. I otherwise would. And so I am overdoing it because I have a limited time. Mm-hmm. Right. And so how do I then go ahead and kind of curb my own behavior to not have it being continual overspending? There's certain things mm-hmm. you can't avoid, right? Like if you're going, you've got to get a flight, you've got to get a hotel, yes. And you've got to get food. But outside of that, what, you know, you don't need to do these big flashy things all the time.
Right. And I'm empathizing with you as a parent because I think that when I think of my own girls and not just my girls, but my mom, it was her 70th birthday yesterday. And so I wanted to do something for her. And so I invited the family to come up and stay with us. And that meant putting some folks in a hotel. And so I was willing to drop some coin mm-hmm. to allow my mom to experience this. Mm-hmm. And as I was thinking about, well, what kind of present do I give her?
Right.
I thought to myself, the greatest gift I could give her is this, the planning and putting this together when no one else was.
Right.
And her being with her family was the greatest gift.
Yeah.
Not anything else. So what you're doing is having that quality time with them. So it's only up to you and your spend plan. What is overdoing it?
Right.
If overdoing it at all.
And so, like I said, I may very well not be overdoing it, but sometimes I feel like I am.
Yeah.
Right. Because I also don't want to, because I move back to them in a couple of months.
Mm-hmm.
And so, don't want to start that pattern to where that then becomes the norm.
Mm-hmm. An expectation.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, on both ends, from them and from me.
Yeah.
And I don't think they have that expectation. They'd be perfectly happy. They're teenagers. Put them in their rooms, right? But and they're happy. But, you know, there is that temptation. How do you tempt them out of their room? Oh, well, I bet you if we go to the go-kart track, that'd be kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
We can't do that every night.
Right. Well, not every night, but what your spend plan will allow you, right? Mm-hmm. As long as it's in the spend plan and you're meeting your needs and still saving, still investing, doing those things, nothing to feel guilty about, right?
But you have to assess and adjust and anchor it, kind of like what we were talking before.
Yes. Right? Those
you gotta go through
four
those
habits.
Steps.
Absolutely.
Of making sure that, and hey, look, sometimes you do have to tweak things. That's okay.
And those four habits that we're talking about can be found in a previous podcast, very near to this one, on the four habits of aligning who you are with what you want. And so there are four different A habits, assess, align, adjust, and anchor. Right. So with this, Matt, I'm also sensing, and even with myself, we all naturally, as humans, have this dopamine surge or dopamine hit when we are spending. But what is the true hit? Is it because I've spent money, or is it because I got that quality time with my children? Is it because I've spent money and I tie a lot of my identity to the actual item? Or did it create a better connection and a relationship with something? That's how you can assess, is this a dangerous precedent that I'm setting? Or is this something that is not going to get me into future trouble? So what's the actual reward? Because that's all that dopamine is. It is your brain's reward system. We have a dopamine surge every time we eat. We have a dopamine surge every time we have sex. It's for survival, right? If we don't do these things, then we will not survive as a human race. So it's a wonderful thing, a wonderful built-in communication system. But we have to sever the tie of compulsive buying with an item to actually what we're looking for, what we think we have gained or have what we think we've been rewarded with as a result.
Yeah, because the thing is very, very seldom what we're actually wanting.
Absolutely. The thing, the item, is limiting.
It's what does that thing represent or what does that thing bring you that you're really looking for.
Exactly. And that's what we're trying to get at, to the heart. And so Dr. Benson, she equated a lot of overspending behavior to eating disorders. And I'm quite familiar with eating disorders myself. When I provided clinical therapy, I saw several folks with eating disorders. Now, I usually did not treat. If they truly met the criteria for an eating disorder, I would have to refer to a specialist. But then I had some folks who were not necessarily meeting criteria for an eating disorder per se, but they definitely had the symptoms to warrant disordered eating. It's the same with spending. We may not have a true spending disorder that would require clinical therapy because maybe it's ruining your marriage or it's ruining your security clearance. You could lose your job. But maybe it's just enough of disordered spending to where it's causing constant discomfort and anxiety. And if unattended to, can develop into something bigger that would require clinical attention. So I would let you know that and we all kind of get caught up in the medical student syndrome. Oh my goodness, Olivia just read the diagnostic criteria for compulsive buying disorder, and oh my goodness, I met every one of those. Well, first of all, I didn't read all of the criteria, and number two, it is not yet classified in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental and Emotional Disorders. And third, you can't just read symptoms and diagnose yourself. Every clinician is going to look at the whole picture. And even non-clinical folks, when we're like, even though I'm a financial therapist, I am doing non-clinical work. So as an accredited financial counselor, Matt, you're going to be doing the same thing as an accredited financial counselor. We have to assess the whole picture. The whole picture is what's going to tell us whether this is a real problem for you or one that you may have internalized, because maybe your spouse keeps calling you a shopaholic, or your children, you know, are constantly poking jabs because they learned to do that from what your spouse was saying. Or, you know, what have you internalized, and how do we separate between the two? Or let me look at your debt to income ratio. Let me look at your spend plan to see what's truly happening, a fuller picture. So Olivia, this sounds all great and good, but what do I do for myself? Well, the first thing to know is what your triggers are. And for me, it's advertising. Advertisers use this thing called psychological engagement. It's psychological operations at its best. And in the Army, we call that PSYOPs. It's a thing. And so they're using sensory engagement within the PSYOPs. And I had a screenshot of a text that I received from DSW, the shoe warehouse that is close to me on the way home, that I have to
Bridge Street?
Talk myself down from at Bridge Street.
Okay. Yep.
Many times, I know that's a trigger. But the trigger was this text message that I got from DSW because I signed up to get 20% off if I started receiving text messages. That was the wrong idea. Because here's what they did. Here, I'm going to read the text messages, and I want you to listen for sensory engagement. What senses are they engaging you in with these text messages? TGIF, what better way to ring in the weekend than when 20% off? Almost everything. Treat yourself starting now. Oh, friends, here's the next text message. Friends don't let friends miss out. 20% off, almost everything ends tonight. This is your sign to shop. I hope I'm not triggering anybody with this. I probably am, so I apologize. You can turn me down if you have to. Here we go, another one. Cha-ching! That's the sound of you saving $10 off the latest spring shoes, perfect for insert plans here. Wow. It engaged imagery. It engaged my senses so I could see myself wearing the shoes. I could see myself with my friends. You don't leave your friends hanging. You give them that 20% off. I'm going to go hang out with the girlfriends. I could see us getting a drink over at Connor's I got to stop dropping names. Again, right. No Army endorsement implied. This is just the shopping habits of Olivia. I was also hearing cha-ching.
Mm-hmm. Well, and right? I mean, they put it all in caps, right? Cha-ching is in caps. Right. Tonight is in, is in caps with three exclamation marks, right? So, it doesn't have that, but it's pretty close.
Right.
I mean, it's the immediacy. It's feeding into that urge and that sense, and they're getting the here's the carrot, the 25%.
Yeah.
It doesn't tell you 20, you know, doesn't tell you whether or not they raise their prices 20%
exactly.
to account to
but
give you 25%
But you still feel like you're getting
off, right?
the deal.
Yeah.
So this is where we need to limit our senses and engage our minds. And that is that beautiful white matter or gray matter that is in our brains, that neocortex, the prefrontal lobes, what separates us from the lower animals. I call it the mohawk of decision making. That's what it looks like in the brain, all that beautiful gray matter that we have that nothing else has. We were given everything we need to make a logical choice. So here's how you do it. You don't sign up to those mailing lists in exchange for discounts, especially if it's a trigger for you. If you're not triggered by these things, okay, fine. But will it become a trigger in the future? If it does, you can text STOP to the advertisers to opt out. You can triple filter your junk mail. You can send it right to trash, block the sender. You can consider paying extra for ad-free streaming services that you talked about, Matt. You're just removing those temptations. My favorite thing to do is I have a family member check the mail and filter junk mail. My 11-year-old, she knows around this time I'm going to start getting these magazines from a company that make fake Christmas trees. And their seasonal decor for Christmas is beautiful. And I'm drawn in sensorily. I am sensorily engaged because that's one of my favorite holiday seasons. It's fall and Christmas. So I naturally look at these magazines like, oh, it's
yes,
so
please.
Beautiful.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And here's what happens. So I do like to decorate, and it does bring a sense of calm and sense of peace in my home. And I like that. But what some folks may do is buy into the idea that if I buy this, it's going to make my life better.
Right.
But that's not true unless there are other things that are changing in your life as well. So, and then we can also attempt to follow these brain exercises that I'll run down quickly with you. And that means engaging the mind. So the first one we actually talked about in a previous podcast recently is savoring what you already have. If you cleaned your house, if you organized your house, maybe you don't want to sell it anymore because, oh, it's peaceful in here. I can actually live in here. The example that I gave, HGTV, love it or list it. Mm-hmm. When you watch that, you can see that, you know, and I don't know if they do this for the sensational aspect of somewhat of a reality TV show, but you'll have folks that have a very cluttered home, not necessarily dirty, but just very cluttered. Who would want to live in that? Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel good.
True. But, you know, even, okay, so if I can take that on a slightly different tangent, I would say...
Please do.
I would say I stopped watching any kind of anything that looked like HGTV or Love It or List It or any of this. Again, no endorsement of any one thing whatsoever, right? But anything that reality show type of things, because what it's driving is oh, well, I really like that, or I should have something like that. And now you're running to your local hardware store buying stuff that you were perfectly content before. Mm-hmm. And that's why I made the comment about paying extra to remove the ads, because if the ad's there and I don't see it, I oftentimes don't have the temptation.
You remove the trigger.
To do it.
Yeah, remove
right?
the temptation.
Or I'll even set up a separate email for thing that is specifically anytime I'm going to sign up for something for any percentage off, I know that's junk. Mm-hmm. I'm going to use this other email that I don't ever check.
That's right.
Right. And then it's going to go somewhere. It's just going to go to the circular hole that I never see.
And I like that you're reminding us that we can do something about this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of that assessment, that ongoing assessment as well. What could potentially be triggering me and how can I control that? I may not always be able to control how I'm feeling, but I can at least control my reaction
right.
to something and change the cue, change the actual routine, change the reward. Mm-hmm. And so another thing, and why we call this engaging the mind, is because these are mindfulness techniques to a certain degree, especially when you're savoring or relishing in something. Not only cleaning your house and organizing your house so it actually feels comfortable, so maybe you don't feel the need to move out, but also cleaning your car. You know, a lot of folks want to get rid of their car because they're just absolutely fed up with how disgusting it's become. Well, clean it. And if you don't want to clean it, maybe you could hire your child or a neighborhood child to do it. And you're giving back to the community, or you're helping your child learn how to earn and spend cash themselves. You can also, ladies, and not just ladies, but men too, because ever since my husband left the uniform and has started wearing professional clothing to work, since he's no longer in the Air Force, he's actually gotten quite the collection of nice professional clothes. He's not an overspender. But you get to a certain point where you no longer need more.
Right.
But you become bored with it. Mm-hmm. And then you no longer savor it. You no longer relish in it. So you can even have a friend show you how to pair clothes differently to kind of reignite that excitement of owning these items and how you put them together. You can even create yourself a savor album of the things that you have at home that you do want to savor intentionally to help re-trigger you differently. So every time I have that desire to go to DSW, I have a picture of three pair of shoes that I could easily wear any day that are comfortable and are beautiful, and I don't need anything new. Savor what you have. Then you can also think of, now there is a daily weigh-in and a weekly weigh-in and a planning your purchase method that Dr. Benson used, but there's no way to give it its full benefit in a podcast. It has to be seen. It has to be experienced. If you're here at Redstone Arsenal and you want to learn how to do that, I can do that with you. And I can also assist you in understanding how to best use those practices. But then there's opportunity cost. What am I giving up if I buy this? What will I have to let go of if I get one more pair of shoes, or if I get one more dress shirt, or if I get this? Am I losing that quality time now with my daughter? Now I can't take her out for that acai bowl because I've spent all my fun money. But then there's this cost per use. And I love your example that you provided. Well received. So why don't you, we'll end on that. And I want you to just, as best you can, I know that they don't have a visual, but I'm sure you can talk through.
Yeah. So the funny thing is, like, I came back from Germany and moved back to the States when COVID was going on. So it was 2020, right? So when I got back, there was about a period of about 2 months where my bicycle was in shipment and it was not going to be there. And it was the middle of summer. And I wanted desperately to go ride a bike, right? Like, I just wanted to get out and feel some fresh air, and mm-hmm. I didn't have one. It's COVID. It is like, there is, all the bikes were bought, right? And so I finally found one bicycle, and it was a starter road bike, and it was $1,000, mm-hmm. right? And so by the time you add everything into it, like, okay, you're going to buy the bike. Well, I'm going to buy some new bike shoes. I need a helmet, because you don't want to ride without a helmet.
No.
That is basic safety equipment. The pedals for the shoes, a couple of spare parts so that in case you break down on the trail.
I love that you included bike clothing, because that actually is very important.
It really is, because it can make the difference between having a short ride or a nice, comfortable, longer ride.
Right.
Like the proper clothing goes a long way. And same thing with the proper bike too, right? Mm-hmm. Like, if you buy a Walmart $100 bike, you're going to get something that's not enjoyable to ride, and you're not going to want to go far, and it's going to destroy your riding experience. If you invest in that, then you're going a little more distance. Now, this is not an investment really per se, because this is a starter bike, right?
Right.
This is like, one, I don't know how much I'm going to do road biking. I typically have done like hardtail mountain bikes. So all in, I think I paid like $1,800 for this thing, right? So, and the way that this thing's actually detailed, I think it detailed it out to be like $1,850. So that very first ride that I went out on that thing, I was like, well, this bike has, this one ride cost me, I literally said this riding down the trail, this ride is $1,850.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. Yeah.
And the next day I rode again and I'm like, well, I'm down to $925.
Right.
Per ride. And so by the end of four rides, I was down to $462 per ride, mm-hmm. right? So now I ride about 40 times a year.
Maybe so built more, in motivation less. To saver.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. It's like I'm going to love this bike for yeah. everything it's mm-hmm. worth. Is it what I wanted? No, I really wanted a gravel bike. I really wanted disc brakes. I didn't get any of that because that's all they had was a starter yeah. bike. And you know what? It's fine. 4 years later, I still have that bike. I'm down to about $11 a ride now. Mm-hmm. I've ridden that thing over 3,000 miles.
Wow.
I still love using it. It are people on super road bikes going to pass me? Absolutely. Right? But it gets me out. It gets me riding. It gets me enjoying the wind and the sun. And it's amazing, right? Mm-hmm. So that cost per use, though, yeah, I paid. It hurt for that initial pain, for that initial buy, right? But now, okay, it's well paid for itself. Yep. And the hours of enjoyment that I got out of it, you can't beat it, right? But it's that cost per use that I initially used to motivate myself to get back out on the trail. Mm-hmm. When it'd been several months since I'd ridden.
That's a great way to put that. And I will put the cost per use calculator in the post so that you can actually plug in some items too. And it also helps you make decisions on smaller purchases mm-hmm. as well. Do I spend the $300 for this pair of boots mm-hmm. that is very comfortable, mm-hmm. that is leather, that is going to last longer? Mm-hmm. And if I use that those boots at least 10 times, I'm paying 30. If I use it 20 times, I'm paying 50, 15 per use. But if I were to purchase the $60 cheap pair, right. they're not leather, they're not going to last long, and they're uncomfortable, but mm-hmm. I only wear them 4 times, mm-hmm. then you're at a comparable cost per use, right. but then your cost per use for the comfortable real leather boots will continue to go down because you'll wear them more. Mm-hmm. But this is not a justification for just purchasing expensive right. things.
Right.
It's truly assessing what is worth that cost.
Well, yeah, if you're gonna buy them and stick them in a closet and never use them, yeah, they cost, you know, you have them for 5 years and they cost $300. Yeah, it cost me $60 a year for these things. Yeah, you've worn them 5 times.
Right.
Right? Like, if you use it, over time, it can be well worth it to buy the higher dollar, high quality things.
And
but
I like
that
the story.
The sacrifice is that you're not buying 15 of these other things. You're buying these.
Right.
As a choice.
And it helps you plan the purchase. And when you plan mm-hmm. a purchase, it's not necessarily compulsive.
Right.
And so you're not engaging in compulsive yeah. shopping or compulsive buying. So I'll end with Dr. Benson's 4 R's. And actually, she said these aren't hers. She implemented them from another mindfulness expert. But she did say that we could recognize the itch to spend, refrain from scratching it, relax into the underlying urge and allow yourself to experience what is going on mm-hmm. internally. Not experience the buying, but right. experience what is going on. What am I really seeking? What do I need to satiate? What am I trying to fill? And then resolve to continue interrupting habitual patterns by following the 4 R's. Mm-hmm. So again, recognize, refrain, relax, and resolve. Mm-hmm. I hope this has been helpful. If you need help, please reach out to me if you are a Team Redstone Arsenal member at 256-876-6299. Looking forward to the next one.